thoroughly unprepared in some ways because I don't know what I'm doing yet. So this will be a discovery sort of thing for both of us. We'll begin at the beginning, or one of the beginnings. A few classes down the line, we're going to talk about creation myths, but this is one of the creation myths. This is called the Plesajean creation myth, and it has a very unusual beginning in that you don't know what the state of things is, but this pair begins all of creation. Eurynome is called the mother of all things. And somehow Eurynome wakes up and she finds this big serpent, Ophion. And she begins this whirling dance. And out of this whirling dance, all of the worlds and everything comes into being. And among the first things created are a group of beings that are called Titans. And the Titans are all incestuous. They are all married to their sisters, meaning to say that they all come from the same root. And the first group of Titans created is completely astronomical. It isn't clear whether they relate to the worlds or to the planets, but Rhea and Cronos were associated with Saturn. Theia and Hyperion were associated with the sun. Phoebe and Atlas were associated with the moon. Dione and Crux are associated with Mars. Metis and Cos are associated with Mercury. Themis and Eurymedon are associated with Jupiter. And Tethys and Oceanus are associated with Venus. And out of all of these, everything else came into being. There were other Titans, and there are many versions of the stories because the myths come straight out of the spiritual worlds, and coming straight out of the spiritual worlds, it's very hard to draw the origin or the source of all things, especially being a human. It's hard to pull them out. And so the origins are not clear. Some, according to some of the tales, Atlas belonged to the second generation. All of these names have meaning. As we said, Eurynome means mother of all things. Themis, as we know, means order or justice. We all know Themis as the blindfolded lady with the scales, if you remember clearly. Eurymedon means wide rule. And so we're getting down to the part of creation that we want to talk about. Usually we'll tell one or two, sometimes more stories in a night, and then we'll look at them. So out of this whirling dance, the gods that are related to the planets or to the spheres or to the realms are created, and they compound with each other, and there are other creations. I didn't look up the meanings of all of the names because it gets to be very laborious, but it turns out that all of the names, the fact, when you get to a language like Greek, almost all of the names are names of divinities. Almost all the words are either divinities or commonplace objects from everyday life, like minims and maxims are where jars, which is where words where minimum and maximum and such like that come from. But Themis and Eurymedon have at least three children, Epimetheus, which means afterthought, and Prometheus, which means forethought. And it also means swastika. So we'll come to some of this later on. I'm going to not try and be too ostensive about this, because when we're talking about myths, we're talking about something that is in the realm of the gods. And therefore, it's something that's completely spiritual. And like pointing fingers, like saying that's a chair and that means that, is not always the best way to deal with that. The best way is to get the spirit of the story, because the spirit of the story is where the meaning is. You can't, you know, like for some people, their lives consist of how much money they make and what kind of an automobile they drive and what their house is evaluated at. And really, the meaning of a person's life is actually in the living of it. And you can't point at the objects, and you can't even that much point at the events without talking about the life that is within it. And so, as we go through the stories, we'll try to get the life of it. Oh, I'm missing an H here. How do you like that? I can't even spell with the thing right.
I'm also missing an E in Epimetheus.
Oh, yeah?
After the TH.
Oh, yeah, EUS. All right. I prove again that I can't spell. I'm the first of the phonetic spellers, and, you know, like I'm belong to the, I'm a generation or two ahead with the new math and with the new spelling. So Prometheus is what we're wanting to talk about tonight. Yeah, I'm not going to battle about things like that. All right, so Prometheus is who we're talking about, but according to some of the myths, a different Titan, Iapetus and the nymph Cleome, are the parents of Prometheus. Iapetus is sort of like a driving, I think the name is means forceful driving. Yeah, it's hurrier. Okay, so we have the character Prometheus, and we want to get the feel of what Prometheus is like. Sort of like when you meet a new friend, you want to know what they feel like, what their character is like. Well, Prometheus happens to be very, very rebellious. And he happens to be very intelligent, and he happens to be very creative. You might say that Prometheus is like some kind of Mars-Mercury type of character. Forceful, rebellious, independent, very creative. Now, things weren't always good, even in the early days, that the Titans were succeeded in future generations by another set of gods. Like Cronos, one of his sons, started a whole new order. There's Hades, Hephaestus, Poseidon, and Zeus, or Zeus. And Zeus, what?
Hestia.
Yeah, but I don't want to go into all of them. Zeus eventually succeeds in the rulership of the heavens. I don't want to go into all of the side trips, but these transitions don't take place smoothly. It's sort of like a teenage rebellion. In order for some people to come into their own, they have to assert themselves, and assert themselves very strongly. And with human beings, it's sort of just the opposite of the way it is with animals. With animals, birds will push the babes out of the nest, and foxes will drive the cubs away at a certain age. And with humans, there is a rebellion. And so it was with the gods, that the Titans decided that they didn't want to give over their kingdom too easily to the new order of gods, and so there was a great war. But Prometheus was very, very cunning. And Prometheus studied the situation, and he said that the new order, he could see that the new order was going to be the order that prevailed. He says, we're not just going to go back to the old ways. And he convinced his brother Epimetheus to side with Zeus in the war in heaven. And eventually they prevailed, and Zeus had the new order of the times. And then the story becomes very, very jumbled and clouded. Atlas was one of the people that, one of the Titans that was involved with the, involved later on still with humanity. He's one of the Titans that was not killed, but he was punished, and he had an eternal punishment, if you remember, of having to hold up all of the heavens in the Garden of the Hesperides. In fact, Atlas was very, very prolific. He had the as his daughters, he had a number of sets of daughters. He had the Pleiades, and he had the Hyades. Oh, I don't know if I'm spelling these right or not. I have John there. If you want correct spellings, look to John. And then the Pleiades are in another way associated with another constellation in the heavens, and that is the Hesperides. I'm not sure if that's an AES or an IES, which are associated with the Great Bear. The Garden of the Hesperides was way in the land of the north. But the forces of the moon had dominion of a large part of the earth. And that large part of the earth were beyond what was called the Pillars of Hercules, and it was called Atlantis. And Atlantis was a place, according to the Greek myths, where the people were very, very cultivated. They had racetracks, and they had temples, and they had all sorts of things, most of which we would call idolatrous or wasteful or something like that. And the Atlanteans were seditious to the rulership of Zeus, and so there was perpetual struggle. And Zeus was about to destroy all of early humanity. And in wanting to destroy all of humanity, he would have destroyed his own creation. And this is where Prometheus prevails. And Prometheus says, don't destroy all of them. You know, let some of them live. And because Zeus liked his counsel, he allowed Prometheus and Epimetheus to create a new humanity. And this new humanity was, the work was done mostly by Epimetheus. Now, afterthought is usually a pretty poor way to learn. And so what happened is that Epimetheus played all of his trump cards first. He gave all of the qualities of bravery and sagaciousness and the ability to run. He gave all of them to the animals. There was a recreation of the animals in here also. Everything that was made out of the earth itself was made by Epimetheus and Prometheus at this time. There was a recreation. And Epimetheus gave all of the qualities to the animal, and when it came to producing humans, there was nothing left over. And so the humans were left in a very bad way. So Prometheus said, we have to do something for this. We can't let them be, because look at humans. We're weak, you know, we can't lift as much as any other animal can. And with our body weight, we can't fly like the birds can. And so Prometheus decided that humanity should have something that gives them an advantage. And so Prometheus is friends with Athena, who is one of the children of Zeus, and one of the children that Prometheus helped beget, because Athena was born out of the head of Zeus, because Zeus had a tremendous headache one day, and somebody took an axe and split his head, and out jumped Athena in full armor. She was born straight out of the head of Zeus. You can see there are all sorts of things that we could have a great time with all of these myths. And Prometheus was very friendly with Athena, and she smuggled him up into Zeus's heaven, and from Zeus's heaven he took a coal, and he put it in the pith of a fennel stalk, and covered it up and took it back to the earth, and he gave human beings fire. And when the human beings had fire, they had a tremendous advantage over all of the other animals, because all the other animals were afraid of fire. And this outraged Zeus, who, even though he appreciated the help of Prometheus at various times in his history, he was outraged at the disobedience and the fact that the fire was stolen and brought to earth and given to humans. And he was going to punish Prometheus, but somehow Prometheus got away with it. And it was decided somewhere along there, there was an argument that with the fire, that the human beings should learn, out of gratitude, they should learn to sacrifice something of their property to Zeus to show their reverence and such like that. And it was decided which part, you know, they were going to slaughter animals and offer them to Zeus, because that's something that was very dear to a human. If the more animals you owned, the more power that you had. And so it turns out that Prometheus was told to help Zeus select the proper parts of the animal to be chosen for sacrifice. Now, Prometheus was really cunning in this, and he took an ox and slaughtered it, and he took all of the flesh and he hid it in the stomach, because that was considered offensive. Because Prometheus loved humans, because he had created them, and he loved his creation. Then he took all the bones, and he covered them up with the fat, and he put them in the hide, and let some of the fat show through. And Zeus came, and he was outwitted, and he saw all of that fat, and he says, that's where the best flesh must be. He says, I select this parcel. And he picks up the parcel, and the first thing that falls out is a thigh bone. And he knows that he's been taken right then and there, because the thigh bone, as it was in the Old Testament, the thigh bone was the most sacred part to be sacrificed to Jehovah, and the thigh bone became the most sacred part to be sacrificed to Zeus. But Zeus was outraged, and so he decided that Prometheus was going to have eternal punishment. And so he took Prometheus, he had Hephaestus, who was the Greek version of Vulcan, who was the creator of all things, and Hephaestus took and made chains, and they took Prometheus to the Caucasus Mountains. And they put up a column in the Caucasus Mountains, and they chained Prometheus to the column, and there he was supposed to spend all of his time in eternal punishment. That wasn't enough, because it got cold and frosty and things like that, so he was exposed to the elements. But the worst part of it was that he had a wound, and his liver was exposed. And so all day long, there was a griffin vulture. And the griffin vulture would come, and it would gnaw away at Prometheus' liver. And then at night, when the griffin would go back to its nest, the liver, as it is wont to do, would regenerate itself. And then the next day, the whole cycle would start all over again. In fact, the first drop of blood that came out of the exposed liver produced the saffron crocus, which supposedly is one of the great healing herbs, and it's one of the great healing herbs that Chiron, the centaur, used for healing people. Chiron, you know, was the only benign one of the centaurs, the half-human, half-horse beings. Most of them were rather roguish. And they were so roguish that they were always getting in trouble. And they were gate crashers. And they gate crashed a wedding. And Heracles happens on the scene, and he breaks it up, and he kills I got the pictures in my mind, but not the words. He kills almost all of the centaurs. A few of them escape, but in the process, he's using his bow and arrow, and he's plinking off centaurs, and he hits Chiron. He hits Chiron in the leg. And Chiron is his friend, because all of the great heroes were trained by Chiron, because Chiron had all of this wisdom. And Prometheus, the blood that produced the crocus, the juice of the crocus was used for healing the wound of Chiron, who was very dear to Zeus, and Zeus began to repent for punishing Prometheus, who he really loved in the first place, because Prometheus was a strong one and did so much creative thinking, and he began to repent about the whole business, because he made up lying stories, and he said that there was an affair between Athena and Prometheus in the first place, and that's tried to make it look all bad, and that stealing fire on top of it was the second sin in the whole place. He was sleeping with my daughter. Heracles, after he has taken care of the centaurs, he gets his comeuppance for it later. We'll discuss that somewhere on down the line. This gets all whining and intertwined. You see, I'm trying to spin together. All of these tales are all bound together, because we're talking about things that are in the spiritual worlds. And in the spiritual worlds, things don't have a beginning and things don't have an end. It's like looking at the astrological mandala. Everything is connected to everything. Or there is that occult maxim, everything is in everything. That in an atom is the whole universe. And so these stories are all tied together. And it turns out that Heracles is the savior of Prometheus, but it's foreordained that only an immortal can redeem Prometheus. And so Heracles, after he has completed his labors, he goes into the underworld, and when he comes out of the underworld alive, having gotten past Hades and having released Theseus and a number of other people in the underworld, he comes back up and he is then an immortal. And he comes back up and goes through the Caucasus and he kills the griffin vulture with his arrow and frees Prometheus, and Prometheus is given the immortality that Chiron now does not want, because even though he's healed, he still has a constant ache and pain, and he's having worked with humans so much, Chiron has like a human consciousness, and he gets weary of all of these years of his life that he's had, and so he gives his immortality over to Prometheus. There's one little hooker in the story, that is that Prometheus was ordained to have eternal punishment. And the eternal punishment then has to be that he has to wear jewelry. All of his chains, Hephaestus takes all of his chains and beats them into a large ring, and out of the stone of the Caucasus Mountains, a stone is taken and set in it as a jewel, and Prometheus has to wear the ring with the stone for all of his days. Now, Prometheus was an instigator in other ways, because after he had stolen fire, and after he had given humanity such strength and such an ability, Zeus was not only angered at the rebellion, but Zeus was sort of jealous of humanity. And so, since Epimetheus was even closer to humanity than Prometheus, he figured a way that he could get his revenge by having humanity turn against Epimetheus. And so Zeus created, the Greeks were in the time of the Aries period by precession of the equinox, and as a consequence, the Greeks were hypermasculine, and they disliked women. And so they have Zeus creating for Epimetheus the ultimate bimbo. She's extremely, extremely beautiful, but she's dumb. And he gives her a sack to take with her, which some people feel is a box. And her name is Pandora. And Prometheus gets his brother's ear, and he says, don't marry her. No matter what Zeus says, don't marry her. You know, pass her up. As beautiful as she is, pass her up. And Epimetheus listens to him, which outrages Zeus all the more. And so what happens is that after the second thing, when Prometheus gets the best of Zeus and he gets pinned to the rock, Epimetheus says, oh, I better not disobey too long. And so he recants. He doesn't want to be chained to a rock himself. He recants, and he marries Pandora, and she gets curious about the bag or the box that has been given to her, and she opens it up, and out of it come all of the woes and sorrows of that have suffered for humanity. And she's so dumb that she leaves it closed. She closes it up when the last thing in it is hope. And so she closes it up and leaves the hope inside. And so all we have are the things of travail. But Prometheus, beside being beloved by Zeus, has a secret. By the way, there's original source material for this, and you get different sides of the story from different source material. The earliest is from the poet, I don't know, I'm terrible at pronunciations as well as spellings. Hesiod, I'm not sure. Hesiod, he wrote Theogony. Which means the birth of the gods. And most of the first story of Prometheus is in the Theogony. Some of it is in one of his other poetic works called Days and Works. And the other original source material is from Aeschylus. I think that's it.
Y-L-U-S.
Okay. And Aeschylus, who is the first of the three great tragedians in Greek, and he wrote a play called Prometheus Bound. And in Prometheus, quite a bit of Prometheus Bound brings out not only the rebellion and the intelligence of Prometheus, but it also brings out his pride. See, Prometheus, with his forethought, is always looking ahead. And he not only knows the trouble that Zeus is going to have with Atlas and the other Titans, and he knows that Zeus is going to prevail, and he lends his support to the side that's going to prevail, but he also figures out what Zeus's downfall is going to be. And so while Zeus has nailed him to the pillar, all the while he's saying, I have a secret. And that secret is of ultimate importance to you. And all the while that he's at the pillar, that he also says, I have a secret. Sort of like, because Zeus, who is all bright, who sees all and knows all, Zeus, every morning when he wakes up, has to hear Prometheus say, I have a secret that is of vital importance to you. It's of, to your whole kingdom. Aeschylus's other play, Prometheus Unbound, was lost, unless maybe some Arab has it somewhere in a scroll, because most of the scrolls out of the Library of Alexandria are in the hands of Arab chieftains, and they occasionally let them loose, like the Gospel of Thomas or something like that. All right, roughly we've looked at the story of Prometheus. So we're going to set that one aside, and we're going to look from a different tradition at a different story, and then we'll go back and we'll tie them all together, and we'll look at the theme, which is the outlook for the whole course, or the whole series of talks. Yes?
Just one thing. I believe that Hephaestus was not a brother of Poseidon
and
Zeus, but a son.
Oh, okay.
Zeus and Hera.
All right. All right, scratch that one in. We'll put him on a different level. My memory in all of these things is not good. I'm terrible with memory, and I'm not at all Epimethean, and I have to suffer a lot because I'm always looking ahead. Not that I had that much forethought, but I like the future a lot.
A lot of people don't know Hephaestus is equated with Vulcan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mentioned that.
Okay.
I've slipped a few things by here. All right, now we're going to turn to the Gnostic version of a Kabbalistic tale. Only this one is going to be much more literal, almost like spiritual science and philosophy straight out. It's not going to be so much of a story. Is it too hot in here? I'll turn the lights down some since we're not... where is that one? Better? Okay. I'm only throwing out a few. In winter, we'll need them, though, because that's the only way we're going to heat, because I'm not going to let the furnace on. It's too noisy. Okay. Now we'll start at the beginning again, only we'll start from a tale that is as much literal truth as it is myth. And we'll tell it according to the mystery tradition. In the mystery tradition, in the same way that there are generations of divinities, hierarchies, in the mystery tradition, the whole solar cosmos in which we are undergoing this evolutionary creation has gone through several periods of expression, which are sometimes called the days of creation. We, in one way of looking at it, are right in the middle of the fourth day of creation right now. So there are big periods of time. And these big periods of time take place like there is a revolution of consciousness through various realms of, you might call them heavens, various realms in the spiritual worlds. And so we have like the physical world is the only one that we know of, and in the physical world we only see a very small portion of it, the solids and the liquids. We don't even see the gases, though they're ultimately necessary to us. Beyond the physical, there are many, many other worlds that are not understood in the same way we understand the physical world. There's a world that's made completely of emotion. And we relate to that one also by having a body made of emotions, not made of physical stuff, but it's, some people call it an astral body, and some people call it a desire body. And like in the Orient, it's called Kama Rupa. And it's a body that's made out of feeling. As well, these different realms have different hierarchies of creative beings. And these creative beings help and create creatures, just like our animals and plants and things in the minerals. There are all sorts of elementals and fairies and demons and other things like that that are beings. You know, like I'm talking very literally now about the same thing that is in all the myths. There are hundreds of different kinds of divinities and fairies and things like that in the myths, only we say that they're myths. You can treat this as a myth too if you like. This is just another part of storytelling. And there are hierarchies that are on Jacob's ladder. They're at various different levels of evolutionary attainment. And they have a glory and a creative work according to their level of attainment. You know, it's like you see that there are some people that play pool better than you, or there are some people that understand music better than you. And with the creative hierarchies, there are grand, big differences. Now, these differences are sort of like stages. We know some of these stages as a mineral-like stage where one experiences form, or a plant-like stage where one experiences vitality and growth, or an animal stage where one experiences emotion and independent motility. And at the same time that there are these physical states, each of these beings is unfolding a spiritual quality, like from the resistance of form, like the minerals do, a spiritual will is developed. From the ability to grow into different shapes, a spiritual imagination is formed. and from the ability to feel different feelings and separate oneself and move around the way the animals do, there is an experience of spiritual individuality. And eventually in the human stage of consciousness, the spirit becomes indwelling in these other vehicles of consciousness, and we have waking self-consciousness from within. Now, everything is phased off, period by period. Now, these periods are named Saturn, when we were mineral-like, Sun, when we were plant-like, Moon, when we were animal-like, and Mars, Mercury, when we are human-like. Now, one step ahead of us is a group of beings called angels. But in the moon period, the angels were human-like. They were becoming human. They were becoming individuated and waking up within their vehicles. But the conditions were altogether different then. The expanse of the solar system was different, and the density was much different. The solar system was no more dense than a magnetic field, an etheric magnetic field, what you would call an etheric field. This stage, or this period of creation, is talked about in Genesis in just about one sentence. The first day when everything was dark is pointed to by Saturn. The second day when there was a light, but it wasn't a light like we have here, it was a light that is like within everything, was the sun period. And as the solar system was condensing, the things were no more dense than a thought in the Saturn period, and no more dense than a desire in the sun period. And in the moon period, things were no more dense than an etheric field. And in the moon period, the earth, or the sun, the solar system, was sort of like a glowing ball, and there was an etheric vapor that rotated very much like our weather system now. You know, like it gets hot at the equator and everything rises, and then it gets forced out to the pole, and then it comes down as cold there, and then it works back to the equator again. And there was this like revolution of etheric vapor. And this etheric vapor is described in one sentence in the book of Genesis as, on the third day, the waters were divided from the waters. Already there were, in this individuation process, in the moon period, some of the angels liked it at the hot fireball. And their first assertion was to not follow and rotate out into the gases, out into the etheric vapor. And they rebelled. And they were called the brightest of all of the angels. They were the lovers of fire. And they struggled with the divine creation and with the divine creator, but they stayed near the fire. And this sector of the angels was called the Lucifers. But because they developed an unbalanced kind of evolution, they could not assimilate all of the wisdom. They were proud and strong and forceful, rebellious beings, but because they didn't have the full evolution, it's almost like if you denied a plant a certain kind of experience, that plant would be deficient, and it would show up in future generations of the seeds from that plant and the seeds of the seeds and such on down the line. And so the Lucifers became as bright and brilliant as they were. The Lucifers were not able to be accepting fully of the Spirit to come into them, and so they lacked the gift of innocent wisdom that the other angels had. And so they sort of lagged behind. And so that when the solar system collapsed after the second day and came out with a new generation, in the what is called the Earth period, Mars and Mercury, they had to struggle. They couldn't become humans because they had no relationship to the material world. But they couldn't assimilate wisdom directly the way the angels did, so they had to get knowledge some way. And so they decided to work on humanity. Now things recapitulate. I don't know how to talk about cosmic creation. I spent 2 years talking about it in classes, meeting once a week, and it still never got said everything I wanted to say. But there is that great law of all spiritual things that goes as above, so below. What has gone before in heaven will follow after in earth. Know this and rejoice. And so like all of the work that was done in the Saturn period, the Sun period, and the Moon period was recapitulated in smaller cycles in the Earth period. I feel like an animal with a tail. And these recapitulations have names. The first recapitulation, when we were human-like in our consciousness, but we recapitulated the mineral state, is called Polaris. And we were still part of the solar system then. When we recapitulated the plant-like state of the Sun period, that was called Hyperborea. Now, in the time of the next period, which is called Lemuria, this is when the Earth was separated from the within the Sun and it began to harden. Lemuria, the Earth was a big fireball, and the humanity at that time was not etheric, as ethereal as it was in the Polarian and the Hyperborean periods. The humanity of this time was called Adam, A-D-M, which means in translation, man of red earth. And so we were, is that thing going? Probably not. Oh yes, it is. Couldn't see it, too distant. We were consolidating as the Earth was consolidating. And as the Earth was consolidating, we had to have new means for perpetuating our physical existence. Previous to this, we could have bodies that lasted a long, long time, like the plants, hundreds and hundreds of years. But two works had to be done. The spirit that we had been developing, the will, the imagination, and the individuality that we had developed in the three previous periods, had to come into our physical body, our etherical body, and our desire body. And so we had to have a vehicle for the spiritual intelligence to be able to work in our creature-like body, we had to have a mind. Not a brain, but a mind. And so our creative spiritual energy had to be used for developing a mind, as well as developing a physical body that could house the mind and be an expression for all of the spirit and the inner bodies. But as the earth was hardening, we had to be able to go into the physical world. So at this time, we were divided into sexes. That is to say, part of the creative energy was expressed in the physical one way in one group of humanity and part in another. That is only in the bodies. The spiritual intelligences, they incarnate sometimes in a male body, sometimes in a female body, and it's usually a balanced type of development. But at this time, as we were beginning to develop a mind and the spirit was beginning to draw in, and the spiritual worlds were being closed off, and we were in a darkened state, and we were very weak, and we were not yet really godlike, we were vulnerable. And this is where Lucifers came in. The Lucifers chose the most advanced of humanity, or the most advanced part of humanity, the bodies that were female. Because the bodies that were female were more attuned to imagination. And they were still more awake in the inner world and were not trying to conquer in the outer world. And so the Lucifers insinuated themselves into their aura and associated with the developing spine, and they were seen as serpents in the spine. And they came into the intelligence of what, unfortunately, some people call the original bimbo in the Kabbalistic tradition, Eve, and showed how we could have immortality and creativity like the gods if we used the sexual energy, which is symbolized by the fruit. The whole thing is, they insinuated a freedom that was independent of wisdom, a freedom that was independent of the workings of the cosmos. And consequently, it would be out of time, and it would be adharmonious, and it wouldn't work with things. As a consequence, Eve taught Adam how to be sexual at will. Not as previously, where we were guided by the angels, the lunar angels, on a honeymoon. We procreated at times that were astrologically harmonious. We chose the route of experiencing it and do it yourself apart from wisdom. And this projected us much more into the physical, much more into a realm of independent desire, and this is called the fall of humanity. This is called the original sin. It isn't the sexuality that's the original sin, it's the selfishness that's the original sin, that we selfishly wanted to be gods all on our own. But we were very primitive. So, now let's make it a little bit more like the myth again, bring back into the mythical sphere. At the same time that there was a division of human beings into male bodies and female bodies, there was also a division into spiritual consciousness that is much more luciferic. Let's look at the story of Adam and Eve. In the Adam and Eve story, there were three children: Abel, Cain, and Seth. according to the Kabbalistic story, there are copies of it. A few years ago, they had the all of the Dead Sea Scrolls and artifacts here at the Wisconsin Center and at the Memorial Library on campus. And they had some of the original Gnostic texts in which it said Eve mated with the demon. And from the union of Eve and the demon came Cain. Abel was born in complete innocence, meaning to say there was no carnal knowledge. See, it was the opposite then from what it is now. Now, sometimes we don't know that there is a spirit living inside of another person unless we have carnal knowledge and we can experience the feel of that other person. It used to be the other way around, that we didn't know we had a body except in carnal knowledge. Now we don't know that there is an internal consciousness except in carnal knowledge. Cain slew Abel, and Abel, in his purity and innocence, according to the myth, this is interpretive now, according to the interpretation of this part of the myth, that means there was no place for innocence in the world anymore, once there had been a fall. Occasionally, some of those parts of humanity that never fell do come into incarnation. And when they do, they live out the myth of the slaughtered innocent. Caspar Hauser was supposedly one of them. According to the notion that there are two Jesuses, one of the Jesuses had never been incarnated previously, but they're always slain as an innocent. After Cain slew Abel, Adam knew Eve, and she bore Seth. And so these are called sins of the widow, children of the widow, because Eve was married to the spirit who she couldn't be with. And so if you look in the Bible, you'll find that there are always statements about widows and how you treat children of widows. And so all of the Canaanites were the children of the widow, because Eve was widowed by the Lucifer spirit Samael after he left her. The children, or what is called son of man in the Bible, is the result of Adam and Eve, and they are the children of Seth. And this points to two very different human temperaments: the children of Cain, the Canaanites, and the Sethites. The Canaanites have the influence of the Lucifers. They are firelings, children of fire. Seth has the influence of the angels, and they are children of water, the waterlings. The Canaanites do things by knowledge. The Sethites do things by faith. If you look, this is something that's carried all the way through. Like if you read Peter in the Bible, for example, and Paul, there's a lot of discussion about whether it's, you see it to this day among the Jesus people. The Jesus people say works are nothing. Faith is all you need. They're children of Seth. Canaanites have to know things. The Canaanites are creators. Like Tubal Cain, Jubal Cain, the inventors of agriculture and architecture, as the same as Prometheus invented agriculture and architecture and all of these things and gave them to humanity, the same is true with the children of Cain. Roughly speaking, now these are temperaments, unlike you can be born in a male's body or be born in a female's body, and that happens all the time. You go through these alternations. But if you are a child of Cain or a child of Seth, that is something for all time. All of our future evolution into the most far distant future will be determined by whether we are a Canaanite or we are a Sethite, whether we are a fireling or a waterling. In general, those who are rebellious but respectful of power versus those who believe in the chain of authority and follow after authority, the Canaanites are sometimes called Freemasons. whereas the Sethites are sometimes called Catholics. And the highest development of the Freemasons comes from going through the mystery schools. The mystery schools that ask, what is a human being? How did we get here? Where are we going? And why? Above all, why? Most people, when they reach their height of development, they become occultists, which is not to be associated with, this black magic kind of stuff, and that you hear all the time associated with the word. The Catholics, when at their highest development, become mystics. Eventually, they get united in the being of the Christos. They get united. If you look back in history, like in India, there are the Chandravansiyas versus the Suryavansiyas, the children of the moon versus the children of the sun. The children of the moon always have a divinity, a feminine divinity that they love. It's not just the Virgin Mary, it's Isis, or it's the Deva Matri. It's always the mothering woman. The Freemasons always have a hero, a very powerful hero who is a creative individual. And the Freemasons' Freemason is Hiram, who is the later manifestation of Cain. The attempts have been made to bring the two poles together throughout history, the building of Solomon's temple. Solomon was the ultimate of the Son of Man, and he, because of his purity and innocence, received the plan from heaven, but he couldn't build it. And so he had to bring in Hiram and the builders. And Hiram, after building the whole temple, tries to outdo the whole thing by putting the furnace to melt down all the elements into the glass, like it says in the book of Revelation, when the whole earth is destroyed and melted down into the glass. Hiram tried to do that a long time ago. And then the children of Seth poured water on the fire, and the whole thing exploded, and he dives into the fire and goes to the center of the earth, and there's all kinds of myths in there. It's just too many. We'll maybe come back to some of these myths in other ways. Ultimately, they are to be united. Lazarus and Jesus were Freemason and Catholic. And the Christos appeared in the Catholic because that was the more pure body. Hiram Lazarus was later called John the Beloved, who is now the leader of all the mysteries. But that goes all down the way. Okay, you see what we're talking about. We are talking about the mysteries versus a religious belief. We're talking about two outlooks on life. Clearly, from the presentation or even the mention of the legend of Lucifer, even though there is divine disobedience, and that divine disobedience brought sin and suffering, something else came out of it. Freedom. Freedom to even go against it, to go against the whole of the creation, even though we have to pay dearly and eventually come back into it, but we come back in freedom, we come back in voluntarily. Clearly, you can see the point of view that I'm presenting this information, and the myths that I chose tonight to present it is to show that the name of this course is called Mythology and the Mysteries. And so I'm talking about the mysteries from the viewpoint of the mystery schools. If you're familiar with Catholicism in its more primitive forms, you read some of the priests and theologians of the Middle and Dark Ages. They know there are mysteries, but for them, the mysteries are to be revered and not to be solved. For the mystery students, the mysteries are to be solved. It's not just enough to live. We have to be creators. We can't be just automatons and obedient children. We have to come into our own as creative beings. However, we have to do that with humility. So now let's go back and look at... let's go back and start looking at mythology and the myths that we looked at tonight. You see, we're not treating mythology as symbolism, because symbolism is a form of materialism. Jung, who was a champion of the symbolist, says himself that the only reason that symbols exist is because there is a barrier between the conscious and the unconscious, between the physical consciousness and the spiritual worlds. And the symbol forms a gateway in between them. But from the viewpoint of the mysteries, we don't need symbols. We're trying to destroy the symbols and get at the life. In the same way that the automobile or the big salary is a status symbol and not the life where you feel things and where you think things and you appreciate life and you creatively give yourself to life, that's the spirit that we're going to look at mythology. We're not going to look at it in a symbolistic way. There's nothing wrong with symbology or with psychology or anthropology or history or any other kind of interpretation of mythology. We'll touch on those things a little bit, but there's all kinds of literature and there are all kinds of proponents from that point of view. We're not going to look at it that way. From the there is a maxim that comes from deep back in the mystery wisdom that a symbol conceals as much as it reveals. And we're going to approach this in the spirit of Jacob Bema. Jacob Bema, who knew the whole Bible by heart, but said, now is the time to do away with the Bible. He says, we should not be looking at something that stands between us. We should be ourselves coming at one with the gods. Okay, that's the spirit that we're going to look at it at. We're going to try and look at the life and not the form. I should warn you, I had only 4 pages of notes tonight, but the classes are inversely proportional to the length of the notes. So they'll look out if I come with no notes at all, which may yet happen. Okay, let's look at our 2 myths. Both of the myths begin with the gods and the heavens. The way we are looking at this, mythology is not as it has come in modern time, oh, it's just a myth. We're looking at mythology as literal, as direct truth. We're not looking at it as an allegory, though we might look at a few allegories. We're looking at it as direct living truth. There may be errors in the way the forms and the stories. We're going to look into the Bible, and we're going to look into a lot of different things. As much as I got time to put into it, we're going to look at a lot of different things. And there are errors in the way things are recorded. And in the way we, you know, there are errors in the way we think. You know, sometimes we get a wrong slant on things. But when we're dealing with the gods and when we're dealing with the heavens, we're looking at it as straightforward truth. Straightforward truth and not just a story. The gods' lives are our lives. Some mystery interpreters, like Rudolf Steiner, claims that literally as above, so below. That we literally take that. You see, these stories are going on perpetually. The character of the different realms or of the different periods or of the different hierarchies are constantly resonating. It's when we come into the world of materials that we see only partial things, and things are very, very limited. But these stories are ongoing all the time. And literally, before we come to birth, the gods live off the stories of our lives in a mythical fashion, and we take a cross-section of them, or as much of it as we can manifest in our lives and bring it into our lives. See, a myth is much better than a roadmap. A roadmap is fine for getting from one place to another in a very limited world, but a myth is like the spiritual worlds. It has all of these different sides and all of these different interpretations and meanings, because they're all part of the same truth, because the truth is so universal. We'll try to, one of the things that we're going to do along the line is we're going to take a myth and we're going to look at it on various levels and from various points of view, and show how each of those is true at the same time. We're going to try to look at various different uses of mythology by the mystery schools. So when somebody says, "Wow, I left my body last night and I went to Mars," sometimes that gets interpreted as a symbol. And they talk about that in being a spaceship, and they actually think that he went to that position in physical matter called the planet Mars. But all of the spiritual worlds, all of the realms that came out of that original creative dance, this is for Mary. If you take Yuri, the spinner, and Themis, the order, Yuri Themi, the spinning, all right? She teaches Eurythmy. If you're interested in a form of spiritual movement, Mary teaches Eurythmy. She'd love to have you in her classes because she has a lot to offer. And if you know, if your friends or your grandmother or somebody who's ill or something like that, Mary will always help out. She's a great spiritual artist. I'm a charter member of her fan club, and just watch her walk or talk. Just watch her as she stands there with her physical presence, and you know that she's brought the spirit into the body. But the different spiritual realms have the names of the different planets. The different periods of time have the names of the different planets, and the generations that succeed each other. You know, it's like the logic of one color being placed next to another color to give you a different effect, or placing one note after another note after another note. When we're talking about the generations of gods and how things have come into being, we're talking about the direct understanding of the spiritual forces. You know, like in the, there are the seven spirits before the throne, and there are the seven thunderers. In the book of Revelation, both out of the book of Revelation, they represent the original qualitative differentiations within the oneness of the one light. And so when we're talking about the creation of Yuri, Noam, and Ophion, we're talking about just that very thing. So we're looking at, you know, locations in space. Like if we look at the generations of gods, according to one of the other theogonies, Uranus begat Kronos, and Kronos begat Zeus. That has to do with the shrinking and expansion of the solar system at different times of evolution. So the myths, you know, like interpreting the myths from our material point of view is a very, very limited kind of thing when we're looking from the material point of view. But if you see it from the spiritual view, all of these crazy myths are all tied together in a kind of oneness, and that's what we're going to try and look at. Both of our myths, the myth of Lucifer and the myth of the Titans versus the elder gods, both of them have a war in heaven. And it's a war in heaven where there is a bipolar differentiation. And in that bipolar differentiation, different kinds of beings are born. And so we're talking just about that. We're talking about an uncertain compound creativity. That's the thing about creation. Even among the animals, its life is for real. Creation is for real, and there is that kind of struggle for it, for things to develop. Both of our myths tell of different tries at the creation of humanity, destruction, because both of them go on, like the child of Prometheus is Deucalion. And Deucalion is like the, John's going to correct me on my spread. Deucalion is like the Greek Noah after the flood. You know, they both talk about the flood. But in our case, we both have the influence by some kind of divine being of the very nascent humanity that brings out in independence. In the Greek version, is unapologetically Luciferic. From that point of view, there is no doubt, though it is pagan, there's no doubt that it comes down on the side of the firelings, that knowledge is more important than faith. And so Prometheus becomes a very great hero, whereas Cain and the Canaanites, the Bible as we have it now, is written by a Catholic temperament, and it was written by the darlings of Jehovah and the children of the moon, and there's no doubt about the flavor that it takes. The war keeps going on. Even the, you know, like all of the chemical actions, it's like the great seer Goethe said that they are wars, that there are wars between atoms. I'm not saying like violent wars destroy things, try to harm each other, but I'm saying that there is a compounding that is going on by the struggle of difference. Everything in the world is accomplished. All the experience that we get is a result of difference. If we can maintain the spirit of unity and go through the experience of difference, we are fulfilling the purposes of evolution. And so when we're talking about the wars that are in heaven, we're living in heaven. It's just that we call this earth, and because it seems very limited, and it's kind of unpleasant quite a bit of the time, that we tend to say that it's one of the heavens, you know. It happens to be a very low one, but it's one of them. We could go into all kinds of details, and we could say that the Promethean mercurial person is born out of Jupiter, the higher mind. That is, the ideational mind gives birth to concrete thought and the cunning as well as all of the intelligence. There is that relation between the higher mind ruled by Jupiter and the lower mind ruled by Mercury. We could go into things like that, but I don't want to go quite that much into detail on all the myths. I'll have to have feedback from everybody on what you like and what you don't like. Obviously, they don't like this much because nobody seems exactly cheered about being here this long. We could look at things like that. And the fact that it's forethought and swastika, you know, because the swastika has to do with the fire sticks, where they used to bring fire down, was by spinning the stick. And everybody knows, I don't know about you, but sometimes it happens to me that I get deep enough into my thoughts and deep enough into my prayers that I can actually feel the swastika spinning up here. You know, there is the mark of Cain, and there is the mark of the Lamb. You know, that those that become psychic or unconsciously vulnerable to spiritual forces, they spin the backwards way in their forehead, and they have in what would be called a negative mark of Cain. But if you have in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, if you do controlled, concentrated, very deep thought or very deep prayer, you literally form almost like the wisp of looking with the inner eye in your forehead, you literally form.
mean you're becoming human?
Yeah. All right, in both cases, in the case of the Luciferic myth or in the case of the Promethean myth, it has to do with actually being brought down and chained to earth. The chains have always been, this is why ghosts carry their chains, the chains have always been the sequences of causes and effects. And if you have a lot of unredeemed causes, you leave the body and you have all of those hovering around you, and before you go through your purgatorial experience, you're carrying around your chains, your burden of all of these things tied together. Very clearly, Prometheus is chained by iron, of all things, which is the planet which is ruled by Mars, by desire. And his liver is open, and the liver is the seat of desire as it manifests in the physical body. The people in Africa who still have a degree of clairvoyance yet and who are unabashed about their feelings of desire, they walk up to one another and they say, "I love you from the bottom of my liver." They're not messing around. They're telling where it comes from. And it's so we see then that it's the whole story with the Lucifers, with the iron and the nitrogen and all the protein, and being the highest protein and the greatest amount of luciferic sulfur, and iron is manifest in semen and in vaginal fluids. We always put our best in terms of the creative stuff into that. And so it's, you know, it even comes right down to the physical level that this is all tied together. In both cases, humanity is taken away from a more ideal state and has a life of suffering. And that suffering is the way our experience is born. And both cases talk about an immortal savior who has roots back up into the gods that go back to Prometheus. Prometheus and Heracles are related, and so both of them are of that nature. Obviously, the ring of Prometheus is the ring of spirit. We become individual. We take our destiny and we hammer it into a ring. We forge it into a ring of our own individual experiences, which is ours and ours alone. The stone that is set in that ring is literally the crystallized experience, the adamant, the diamond-hard soul body that is brought out of earthly experience. When carbon, which represents the basis of human experience, is compact together as perfectly as it can be compact, it becomes diamond. And so, like the stone and the ring represent the redeemed state of humanity, so Prometheus, the progenitor of humanity, as well as the redeemer of humanity in the creation, are both indicated in this cycle of this myth. I want to end this up very quickly. I promised myself that I'd keep them under 90 minutes. So both of these are stories of rebellion, but they're also stories of freedom, and they're stories of creation. And we are all ultimately to become creators. This was the secret that Prometheus had in the first place. The secret was that Zeus, out of Zeus's children, would come one that was greater than him, that would overthrow him. And he would overthrow him by creation. See, the mystery schools are like the Gnostics. Everything we are. See, the myths are in us, all the way from the way the organs of our bodies are built to the way we respond to tragedy, or like a death or something like that. We're going to look at Orpheus in a couple of talks down the line. How we respond to death and tragedies and things like that. All of those things are right in us. But as we come into our own, we have to take the Gnostic the Promethean, the Luciferic-like attitude. The Gnostics studied astrology, and they studied it ardently. You know why? They studied it so they would know what the gods were up to, and so they would do just the opposite thing. In the Bible, it is said, 'Tis more blessed to give than to receive. Or that was early, toward the very end of the Gospel of John, it said, "You freely have ye received, now freely give." During the whole of our creation, before we became self-conscious, we were creatures. We were receivers. We were takers. Everything was built into us. Everything was taken care of for us. We got every experience exactly as we needed it. When the Promethean fire was given to us, that was not just a fire stick. That was a little tiny coal, because if it was in a fennel stalk, it was a little tiny, it was just barely more than a spark. And with that spark, when that is born in us, we become creative flames. Literally, for us to be seen with the clairvoyant eye, the spinal fire, the serpents that rise and come out through the voice box, we're like a flower that's made out of flame. And so the Gnostic, the Promethean, the Luciferic spirit, where we throw out the gods and we evict them, we extirpate every influence of them from us, and we become manifestations of the one in ourselves, is done, and it's done by creativity, by lovingly giving of ourselves and taking all of those influences that have been implanted in us and giving them out from us. We become beings of pure light, and we ourselves become gods and creators. And that is what the whole evolution is about, and that is why we're taking the Promethean stand about the secret is that we have the power to overthrow Zeus, the chief of the gods, and we can do that by creatively living and by letting the light come into us more all the time, or letting the light come from us more all the time. Okay, so that's the way we're going to be looking at the myths, from the viewpoint of the mysteries, from the Promethean way. This is why we took the Prometheus myth, which we could have looked at a whole bunch of other ways. I have a friend that teaches comparative literature. She teaches out at California. And some of the same myths that we're going to be looking at in this class, she does in her classes, and she does them from a literary point of view. There have been, if you take the history of Western literature, it's just filled with all sorts of examples of poets or dramatists or people writing operas that have taken and given Prometheus rebirth again. There probably are films also that take the Promethean myth and live them out. And so that's what we're going to try and do, and we're also going to try and have fun. Because, you know, it's storytelling, because if we get too studious and if we get too heavy, please somebody raise your hand and say, "I'm not having any fun." Because that's, you know, when you tell stories, you have fun and you live in the stories. And that's about as far as we're going to go tonight. For the next several times, maybe one, maybe two, maybe three, we're going to talk about the myths that have been used in celebrating the mysteries. The myths, perhaps, of Isis and Osiris, the myths of Dionysius Zargos, or the myths of Proserpine. And probably Orpheus for the Orphic mysteries, because Orpheus ties together those two streams very well. And so in 2 weeks, we'll probably be talking about Dionysius and the original Adam Kadmon we may take two or three parallel myths, each show how each one gives a different side. That's it. You look like you're about to